Thursday, March 14th, was one of those terrific pummeling White House days. Stretch and grind and use you. Even I, who only live on the periphery. So what must it be like for Lyndon? The headlines were, Kennedy is considering race against Johnson. Johnson urges Hill to act on D.C. problems. Fowler urges Congress to act on fiscal problems. Cites gold rush, war, inflation, pleads for tax rise, mad rush in Europe, gold buying skyrockets. Lyndon asked me to get Clark and Abe on the phone and ask them to come over at 8:30. I had meant to get in my 30 laps in the pool before the beauty parlor, but a meeting of this gravity and interest was too compelling, and so I sat on the green sofa in the West Hall and listened to these three strong friends discuss our future and our actions and plans. Lyndon is quite convinced that Kennedy is running, but then he has been all along. I went to Mr. Pears and had a rush hairdo and was back at the White House with just 10 minutes to change for the arrival ceremony into my green Marquise ensemble and then to Lyndon's office, welcome, rattling off instructions to Ashton as she walked beside me. We marched out onto the South Grounds, Lyndon and I, to a sizable crowd of people, a ripple of applause greeting us as we went. Wow. And I, at least, in what I've come to think of through the years as my riding in the tumbril attitude, means shoulders just a bit squarer and head just a lift higher. It was chilly and bright and beautiful, with the flags whipping in the wind and the call of the trumpets making your blood leap. Dean Russ stepped forward, and I said, "You are my hero." And then the big black car rolled up, and out stepped the Prime Minister of Somali, a youngish, round-faced, pleasant and able-looking man, wearing a white embroidered Muslim cap, and accompanied by a delicate, pretty wife, whose soft-spoken English was excellent. And I was impressed, too, with the simplicity and straightforwardness and the ease of the Prime Minister's speech. Then inside for the receiving line, which was quickly over, and the Prime Minister and Lyndon left for their talks, and Sylvia took Mrs. Egal to Blair House. I was back upstairs by 12 with a full hour to work with Liz while we had a sandwich on our next big women doers luncheon, this one on child health and the work of this administration in that field. We had a list of possible guests from HEW, from Matilda, from our own acquaintances, Katie Lockheim, I called Bess Jones. They are composed of professionals, doctors, nurses, psychiatrists, people who work in the government, a governor's wife, bureau heads in HEW, wives of congressmen who carry the ball for health measures, writers on health, and very much volunteers. The sort of woman who dreams, fights, builds a clinic in her own hometown, such as Bess Jones did. And then it was one, time to go over to the cabinet room for the awards that Lyndon was giving out to the federal career women. The seven of them, lined up against the wall of the cabinet room, facing the battery of cameras, were an interesting group, ranging from a wildlife biologist with interior and a statistician with economic advisors, and an attractive young Negro woman with the Office of Civil Rights, to an air traffic control specialist with the FAA. Lyndon made a sweet speech, half humor and half earnestness, lauded them, shook hands, and was gone in moments. I stayed a little longer to talk with them about their work, and then very soon was back upstairs to complete hacking out with Liz the list for our own women doers, to find the volunteers, and those are the ones that I especially want to pinpoint and honor. Is the hard job, and we particularly want to have leaders of organizations connected with the field of child health, such as PTA and Junior League and the JCs. We got it in good shape, I think. And then I made my third change of clothes for the day. Sometimes living in the White House means a ridiculous number of changes per day, one for each occasion. And in my nearly favorite red suit with the navy trim, I left for the circus. This has been an annual event with me and one that I have liked. Each year, the Feld brothers give a free performance of the circus for about 6,000 children from Junior Village and the United Givers Fund agencies, all the neighborhood homes. Does it matter that I go? I don't know. At any rate, the Fells seem to appreciate it. And as I walked through the lower level next to the rings, looking to right and left and smiling and waving, there was a little ripple of excitement and giggles and pointing and clapping that followed me on my way. Mr. and Mrs. Israel Feld and Irvin Feld and a clown and John Ringling North had met me at the door, and together we all marched down to my seat which was right between a little boy named Brian, who was very talkative, and a little girl who silently sucked her thumb, and I couldn't get her to say a word as hard as I tried. The circus never paused on me. My favorites were the dog and pony show. Ellen Thomas leaned over and asked me, "Does it remind you of Yuki?" Yes, it did. And the most adorable poodles. And then a beautiful spectacle on the trapeze. Costumes of red and white like peppermint stripes. The lovely stars entering wrapped in white fur and snow falling. The Fells and I snatched bits of conversation about Roy Huffines, who has bought a large piece of the circus. And they told me how many of the performers were families that go on for three generations or more, particularly the stars on the trapeze. Cotton candy came by and popcorn, and I tried to get a bite between flashes of the camera. It was easy to oblige them with vivid interest. I'll be hopelessly old when I don't like the circus. It was an intermission a little past four, and I said goodbye to Brian and the Fells and made my way out among the crowded rows, shaking hands to the right and left and being pursued by giggles, straight-out questions, "You Miss Johnson?" And then back in the White House limousine and home before five to work in bed, because it's surprising how tiring it is to try to give out to make all those children feel that it was a little something extra to see the First Lady there, the President's wife. I cleared the desk with Ashton and called our house guests and welcomed them, the Perry Basses from Fort Worth and George Noakes from Waco and Tex and Wiki Goldschmidt. And then Mr. Pear came in for a comb out. I put on my pink Molly Parnas with a beaded jacket, one of those wonderful dresses that I always wear. And I don't know what's quite right and need a lift. Oki came and we made pictures. I'm trying very hard to get some good ones of me in evening clothes, because I'm still sending out ones made in 64. Whenever in my life will I wear more evening clothes or have a better photographer than Oki? Every day here, I have tried to live it to the utmost. For this job, for this house, and for me. There was a beautiful bouquet of pink and white roses. I leaned over it, and I think we will get some good ones from it. A medley with my pink and white dress. At 20 minutes of 8, I heard that Lyndon had gone over to the State Department for a reception for Trowbridge. A goodbye. My heart sank. How could he possibly get back and not be late? He could. He did. He stayed 7 minutes, kissed Nancy, thanked Sandy, made an amusing speech. Okay. He said Trowbridge had promised him one thing, he wasn't going to run for president. And then he paused and said, "I ought to point out that that was a week ago." And he was back at the White House and in a black tie, and we went actually downstairs at the North Portico a few minutes past 8. Very for a great deal of his day, time is Lyndon's servant, not his master. He wrings from it every action, every achievement, every human contact that he can. Simone had reminded me that we were on TV tonight, so we tried to take an extra moment in the greetings on the North Portico. The Prime Minister, once more in his little Muslim cap, but a black tie. Mrs. Egal, quite elegant. We took them upstairs to the Yellow Room, where Hubert and his trip to Africa was much the center of discussion. And when Mrs. Warren reached over and kissed me on the cheek, the first time I ever remember, I felt that it was the same sort of salute, and I was grateful that I wanted to give to Dean Rusk for his magnificent performance before the Inquisition on Monday and Tuesday. Among our gifts to the Prime Minister and Mrs. Egal were the bamboo bowl in vermeil, which we use on all the White House tables when we have a state dinner, and 30 boxes of toys for her to distribute among her favorite orphanages. It was a slightly uncertain situation because he has two wives, and I didn't know quite what to do about the one she left at home. Well, anyway, the bowl will do for the house. Their gifts to us were an ivory desk set, quite complete and very attractive, including an ivory pencil holder which we can put to use right away. The Prime Minister laughingly remarked, "Mr. President, I can assure your Congress that this didn't cost more than $50, which shows he's done some research." Behind the flags, we marched down the steps to the tune of "Hail to the Chief," and there's not a day here, no matter how battered with problems, that my heart won't rise when I hear that. And we stood in line in the East Room to meet our 140-odd guests. From the cabinet, there were the Clark Cliffords, and Mr. Justice Thurgood Marshall represented the court. was only one member of the Senate, the Claiborne Pales, and he came apologetically quite late for the that he had stayed on the floor to make the one extra vote was needed to pass the gold cover bill. What a cliffhanger. Gardner Atlas were there, leaving next week for Italy, and the John Baileys from the Democratic Committee. From the entertainment world, there was Sammy Kahn and Pretty Kitty Carlisle, whom I had met at Mary Lasker's, and Barbara Rush, a movie star. When a young man on Lyndon's staff saw her name on the list, he tried to wangle a seat next to her. From education, there was Professor Castagno, an outstanding authority on the Somali Republic. Quite a limited breed, I should think. And the chairman of the board of Sinclair Oil, Mr. Frederick Bush, with whom I had a very pleasant moment's conversation, congratulating him on the very handsomely designed filling station in Georgetown. He said there are going to be more of them all over the country. In fact, he was so interested in conservation, in what our environment looks like, that he said when he retired, it's going to be soon, that was going to be his major concern. There were a sizable number of congressmen present, six, I think, including our old friends, the Harley Staggers and the Clement Zablockis. And from the government, Dick Helms of the CIA, Leonard Marks of the USIA. Besides our house guests, no other Texans, except the Charlie Blakes, who used to be one of Lyndon's district men, but now lives in Washington. And a great pleasure it was to have him here. From the press, the familiar face of Bill Tice, who has covered us since the early roaring Senate days. I'll always look back on them with affection. Frank Reynolds of ABC. And a newfound friend of the press, Joe Garagiola. And that, too, must be a rare breed these days. Was on, I think, the Today Show. Bess and I had spent time on the seating, especially Lyndon's table and mine. Next to the Prime Minister, there was Mrs. Rusk. And then George Woods, with that relaxed feeling of a man who has just laid down a big burden. He and I talked about Mary Ellen Monroney. He's a very attractive man. And then friendly little Mrs. Sam Gibbons, the wife of a congressman from Florida. Seated next to a tall, dark Californian, Eugene Klein, a businessman and Johnson supporter. On the left, I had the Minister of Foreign Affairs, whose English was scant and difficult. And then a very good guest, Mrs. Strauss, whose husband is Assistant Administrator for AID. Pretty, an asset to the table, and as much in love with Washington as I am. Robert Massey, who wrote Nicholas and Alexandra, was between her and Elspeth Rostow, certainly one of the nicest seats in the room. It was a pleasant light dinner for conversation. The Prime Minister and I talked about the search for oil in his country, which has been going on about 15 years, unsuccessfully so far. My knowledge of Somali is limited to frankincense and myrrh and leopard skins, which didn't lead to any extensive conversational gambits. But he was a pleasant, easy companion. And I was very intrigued with Mr. Massey, who himself has a son with hemophilia. That's how he began to write the book, which is the most monumental job of research that I can remember. We talked of how amazing it is that all that great bulk of letters, the diaries, and the eyewitness accounts survived and they themselves were killed in such a holocaust. Lyndon's toast praised the Prime Minister for doing so much to lessen the tensions which threatened East Africa with the waste of war. The Horn of Africa had long been a tinder keg, enmities between Somalia, Kenya, and Ethiopia. Somehow, this man, our fate, has brought about a period of cessation and of peace. And then, when the Prime Minister rose and made his toast to Lyndon, a very nice one, I almost thought he was quoting from Jack Valenti. He rested well. The great power of this country was in the hands of the man now at the helm. I took the Prime Minister into the Red Room for coffee afterward, and Perry Bass, who has traveled much in his country and met many of the officials, but not the Prime Minister, came in and I introduced him to the Prime Minister's wife, and then he joined the group where Lyndon and the Prime Minister were talking. He's been searching for oil for some 5 or more years there now, and his manager in charge plays golf with the Prime Minister. Others came in, and I particularly tried to introduce the news ladies to the guests of honor. And then, at a word from Bess, we went into the East Room, which was, for tonight, arranged in a different pattern. The marine band against the window where Linda's altar had been, and the chairs in a wide semicircle in front of it. As soon as the room seemed full and the guests of honor were in their seats, I went to the microphone and introduced Anita Bryant as a star of stage and television, and now as our friend, whom we were thrilled to have back on the White House stage. Anita looked absolutely lovely in a sheer, floating, pale pink Indian costume trimmed in gold. She sang The Man of La Mancha, which always makes my heart take wings, and she closed with the Battle Hymn of the Republic, with Lyndon leading the standing ovation for her. We've met many performers in the White House, and I think I have become friends with quite a few. Bess must be friends with dozens. Anita is one of the warmest, most natural, most likable, and I think a surefire hit for the average American audience. During dinner, I had asked the Prime Minister what time it was according to his home country. He had said, I think, 2:30 a.m. That was about 9:30 when I asked him. So I was relieved for my husband and for him both. Shortly after the entertainment was over and the champagne was passed, and a little lingering and talking in the hall, he and Mrs. Egal made their departure. Lyndon followed soon. I lingered a moment to talk to the gardener Ackley's, to strike a blow for conservation with Mr. Frederick Bush of Sinclair, and to have a moment's interesting conversation with the young actress who at the National is doing The Homecoming, Harold Pinter's horrible play that I loathe. And for the first time, I got a sensible explanation of it from the man accompanying her, who is in some theater capacity. He said she, the woman in the plane, was just daring, demanding that her husband come out of his icy shell, grab her up by the scruff of her neck, and take her back home where she belonged. But no such healthy reaction from Pinter. I had sent word to the Basses and the Noakes and the Goldschmidts, our house guests, to join me on the second floor for a drink. And before dinner, I had asked Bess to see if she could get word to Anita Bryant and Bob Green, her husband, come on over from the hotel to spend the night in the Queen's room. So the nine of us converged on the second floor. Anita took off her shoes, and we all settled down to a happy hour. The Basses talking about meeting their four children and friends on a Caribbean island for a real family vacation. George Noakes to talk Waco and politics. He's a former state senator, lawyer, businessman, and longtime friend of ours. Tex to talk about the uranium exploration in Somali. And Bob and Anita to tell us all about their lovely house in Florida and to laugh about the evening we had spent in Lucy's kitchen on the day she had been expecting Lynn, but she turned out instead to be dancing until about 2 o'clock in the morning and then brought them all home for scrambled eggs. Lyndon came in his robe about 12:30, through with two envelopes of night reading, but with more still waiting, looking very weary, but adding to the evening by being a warm and friendly and relaxed host for just about 15 minutes before I said, now I know what's waiting for you, so you have to go back. And so to bed about 1 o'clock, on what had really been quite a good state dinner, under clouds as heavy as I can remember.